before Big Ben's throw, before Santonio Holmes' catch, before Pittsburgh became Sixburg, there were doubts. There was a daunting schedule. There was a dominant defense. This is the season. 2008 Pittsburgh Steelers.
Welcome, Steelers Nation. I am Bryant McFadden, your host and cornerback on the 2008 Pittsburgh Steelers. On this podcast, I'll revisit our Super Bowl run from a decade ago with former teammates and coaches, delivering you behind-the-scenes insights and memories on the biggest plays, personalities from that memorable season. Let's get to this week's game and guests.
Steeler Nation, we're back recapping the 2008 championship season. Pittsburgh Steelers, we are on now to week 13. And before we get started recapping that week 13 victory against the New England Patriots, I must give a quality introduction to the guy that was the mastermind of that outstanding historical great defense at that time. No other than Pro Football Hall of Famer. 14 years as an NFL coach, NFL player, 45 years as an NFL coach, two-time Super Bowl champion, defensive coordinator, was on the Steelers sidelines drawing up outstanding defensive plays for 13 seasons. Dick LeBeau, thank you, coach. It's an honor having you on this important week 13. Steeler fans are jumping for joy knowing that the mastermind is on. Coach, it's an honor. How's everything going with you?
Well, you know, the Steeler Nation is universal, and it's always an honor to have anything associated with the Steeler Nation, and particularly with one of my old players, B-Mac. It's great to be talking to you, pal.
No question, Coach. It's an honor, you know, having you on. And before we recap that week 13 victory against the Patriots, Steelers won that ball game 33-10. Matt Castle was the quarterback for the Patriots, filling in for an injured Tom Brady. But before we do that, Coach, you're an iconic individual, not just for the city of Pittsburgh, or not just for the city of Detroit, because that's where you played, but for the football world, in my opinion. And when you look at your legacy, I mean, it's unbelievable, Coach. You've been a part of the NFL world for what? 59 years. 59 years. You started off, as a player with the Cleveland Browns in 1959, and then you went on with the Detroit Lions from 59 to 1972. But let's talk about your time as a player, because if you don't know anything about Coach LeBeau, and many people only know Coach LeBeau as a coordinator, as an outstanding coach. But before he was a coach, he was one of the top corners in the league. 62 career interceptions. That's still a Lions franchise record. Tied for seventh all time in NFL history. You had 762 interception return yards, which currently ranks third all time in team history. Extremely durable. 14 years, you played in 185 games, placing you fourth on Detroit's all-time list. Coach, and I used to talk to you a lot about this while I was playing in Pittsburgh. Your time as a player, having over 60 interceptions, you know, what was your biggest, your best attribute as a player?
I was, I just wanted to be known as the hard worker, as the guy who prepared for the game. I always took pride in as you can remember, from when we were together, Brian, of being a good tackler, a good run forcer, and I always made you guys stick your nose in there, show up. There weren't no cover corners on the Steelers.
No,
we
sir.
Were all going to go up there and get our clothes dirty and get in there with the rest of the defense. And that's the way I played. I always took a lot of pride in that. And the fact that I was able to play in 171 straight games, which for a defensive back is pretty unusual those were the best things. And I do take pride in my interception total. It was 62, and it was in an era when they ran the ball a lot more than they do now. They didn't throw the ball like they do now. So I know I would have got a few more if I was playing in today's game where they throw it every other down. I also often say that I think I dropped as many as I intercepted, because after about 7 or 8 years, your hands are so mangled up you can't catch anything. I was fortunate to play with some great teammates and some really good defenses. And we did, it was almost impossible to run on us, so they did have to throw on us a little more, and it was a little easier to predict when the pass was coming. And that helped me with the interceptions, but it was mostly great pressure from my teammates. And if you remember, we always stressed that pressure aspect with the Steelers, mm-hmm. and enabled our guys back there in the secondary and the linebackers to get some good interception totals when we were all together.
Yes, sir. And talking about great teammates that you played with in Detroit, you played with some nice Hall of Famers. Dick Knight, Train Lane, Lim Barney, Yale, Larry. Talk about those guys in the secondary and what and the chemistry you guys had, because of course, you know, Night Train Lane was probably, I guess, the tone setter, to say the least. But you talk about Lim Barney, outstanding player who also wore the number 20, to be exact, a number that I wore while I was in Pittsburgh. Talk about what that meant to you, playing with so many outstanding players in the secondary and the chemistry you guys had.
You know this, Brian, from the years teams that you've been on, that once you have a teammate, you become brothers for life.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing about the great Steeler team that we're talking about on this phone call, and the great championship team that they were, all of those guys stay in touch, and you can confirm this, because mm-hmm. You talk to them all the time. But you will not only do that now, but you'll do it for the rest of your life. And I still talk to all these guys that we're talking about.
Wow.
And, there's a bond, you know, that you go through. There's a physical debt, and there's a mental preparation. And you spend so much time together, you know, and maybe it is a cliche, you say we're family, but yep. You really do become family.
And that's something that I tell people all the time. You know, anytime I reminisce and think about, you know, my time there in Pittsburgh, it wasn't just a working relationship. We actually loved each other. We actually spent time with each other away from the football facility. And that showed on Sundays as far as the chemistry we had. A bunch of guys that were willing to do everything in their power to make sure we win ball games and didn't care about who received the media attention or the accolades. And I think that played a lot with us, because it starts with the head and it trickled down to the players. And of course, you, coach, you know, having the respect that you had and also being able to command the room like you did for us was huge. Coach LeBeau, you were inducted into the Hall in 2010, and I was there. We got an opportunity to travel with you to Canton. Was an unbelievable experience for me and for my teammates. We all wore we all got Dick LeBeau jerseys. Coach, do you remember that, when we all traveled to Canton and your number 44 Detroit Lions jersey?
It's one of the very, very highlights of my life. I'll never forget it. I've always been indebted to the Steeler organization. This is probably not talked about much either, but the owners, the Rooneys, they shut down training camp.
Yes, and, yes.
The whole team, the whole coaching staff, Canton is not that far from Pittsburgh, and that probably made it possible. But they all came to my induction ceremony, and And what an honor. It was such a thrill for me. And I did okay, but I noticed that I had to quit looking at you guys. I don't think I would have made it through that thing, because just seeing the joy in your faces. And as we talked about earlier, family and the pride that you take in the effort and the performance, that defense was a very, very special defense. And then to have them all there that day, I will always be indebted to all of you, first for wanting to come, and second for the Steelers to arrange it that you could all be there. And it was, do I remember? I'll never forget.
Yeah, that was an unbelievable experience for me also, being a part of your coaching style and philosophies, and being able to see it paid off. Rightfully so. It took them long enough, but you know what? You're now in the hall. You will forever be known as a Hall of Famer. And with that being said, as we transition into your coaching career, you started off as a special teams coach with the Philadelphia Eagles. You had a short stint with the Green Bay Packers, of course, Cincinnati as a DB coach, and then DC in Cincinnati, traveling to Pittsburgh as a defensive back coach, and then DC, and then of course going back to Cincinnati as a defensive coordinator, interim head coach, and then going right back to the Steel City, Buffalo, before returning to the Steel City. And of course, a few years ago, you finished off in Tennessee. But when you look at your coaching career, coach, you coached a lot of outstanding players. You had quality opportunities, but the Pittsburgh element, as far as your coaching career, as far as the organizations that you were a part of before Pittsburgh and after Pittsburgh, tell the listeners the difference as far as the Steel City, the organization, the tradition, the prestige, when you look at some of the other organizations that you coach with.
Well, again, I was blessed again, Brian. I was, for all those years that we alluded to in coaching, the bulk of my coaching career, I was 18 years in Cincinnati and 16 years in Pittsburgh. And I think there was a total of 5 different teams that I've coached for. And I know coaches that have done that in 6 years. in our profession, you tend to move around a little bit. But I was lucky to be able to really centralize my coaching career in those, primarily in those 2 franchises, not completely, but primarily. And there are a lot of similarities. They were both early franchises in the league. They were both family-owned, family-operated. In both places, you never really needed a contract. If the owner told you something and you were talking to him, that's the way it was. It was different than things are today, for sure. After several years, I never even signed the contract till halfway through the season, but it didn't matter. We had each other's word. I do believe I've been to 6 Super Bowls, and only 1-2. Lost 4, but I'll take those percentages. My 2 championship teams were both Steeler teams. I went there 4 times as a Steeler, twice as a Bengal, and each time was with a tremendous group of players. But of course, those 2 championship rings on my fingers are both Steeler rings, and I will always feel a little bit closer to the players in particular that fostered my career, that kept my name popular, that really kept my name bouncing around long enough to get into the Hall of Fame. I love all of you guys. The defense that we're talking about today is probably as good a defense as ever stepped on the field. And, the numbers and the statistics that they put up, I doubt if they're ever equaled again. The game was very wide open when you guys did what you did. but it seems even more so wide open now, higher scoring. And your guys' statistics rated back to the 1960s when I was playing, and we were leading the league. And I've looked at all the stats, and it's not that much difference. You didn't give up that much more yards than we gave up, and it was a different game when I played. So I'll always remember you guys. I'll always remember the season that we're talking about. And I'll always thank my lucky stars that I got to coach you guys.
Coach, talking about the 2008 championship team, the defense, no question, was an unbelievable unit. Like I said, throughout many opportunities on the podcast, that we held 13 straight opponents under 300 yards. We were first in points allowed. We were second in rushing yards allowed. We were first in passing yards allowed. When you look at all the personalities that we had on that defense, you know, you look at James Ferrier, Casey Hampton, Troy Polamalu, James Harrison, Larry Foote, Deshae Townsend, Ike Taylor. With all the personalities that we had, and you knowing each player extremely well, how did that go into your thought process as far as developing a game plan week in and week out?
Well, with the roster that we had, and you just put some of the statistics out there, but I mean, nobody ever did anything running hardly at all. They couldn't get to the line of scrimmage. And those kinds of numbers are 1960 type numbers in the National Football League. I realized pretty early on how good you were. And most of the preparation that I tried to do to make sure I stayed out of your guys' way and let you go do your work. And you were so good. I've always tried to look at the team that I'm coaching, try to discern their strongest assets individually, and then try to incorporate that in a defensive scheme that will allow them to play to their strengths and to minimize their weaknesses. And getting to know the individual, understanding their personality, understanding some of their likes and dislikes. You cannot incorporate everybody on the defense into everything. But we had, you can remember this, we had various defenses that stressed the strengths of various players. And I thought that we could match the opponent, what their strengths and weaknesses were, with the ability that we had. And we spent a lot of time trying to just get you guys to understand what the opponent was going to do, and then enjoy Sunday afternoon watching you get it done, or whenever we were playing Thursday night or whatever. You guys were so consistently difficult to move the ball on. And there was no weakness. There was no spot in that defense where the opponent could say, well, we can go here and have a percentage of success, because they were going to have a problem wherever they went. And then that spatial quality of any great championship team, and that was togetherness. Probably as strong with that group of men as with any group that ever stepped on a football field anywhere. And maybe a little bit underrated in terms of, you know, you're always going to talk about the athletic ability, how strong, how fast you guys were, how team-orientated you were. But you guys were smart, and you were a smart defense. And we could make changes in between downs. We could make changes at halftime. We could adjust if something that I thought was going to be okay wasn't. I could easily go to plan B with you guys. And quite often, before I got the damn thing drawn up on the board, you guys said, yeah, we got it. We did that 2 weeks ago. Or we did it a month ago. And that was a blessing from a coaching standpoint. But those are strengths that you can't teach. and it was more character of each of you guys individually and collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you went all the way and won a tremendous string of games at the end of the year. That's a very difficult thing to do in the National Football League.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
No question, Coach. When you look at the game, the innovation of the game has changed dramatically, especially that year when we started to see a lot of spread attacks, a lot of teams doing no huddle, coming to the line in a no huddle formation, trying to catch the defense, you know, a little bit on their heels. And one of the strengths for us was the ability to incorporate fire zone concepts. And you have been known to be the creator of the fire zone, credited to being the creator of the fire zone. And that's something that a lot of teams are running. Throughout football, from high school, from the collegiate standpoint, we ran a lot of fire zone concepts at Florida State, and being a part of what you did in Pittsburgh. First thing I would love for you to explain, you created the fire zone. And I remember having this conversation with you one day at practice on the sideline. I was like, Coach, why everybody wants to give you credit for the fire zone? And could you explain to the listeners how you came up with that concept before it actually became the fire zone?
Well, the offenses had pretty much caught up with the man-to-man blitzes, which are still popular, will always be run. We ran them, not as many as the fire zone, but they're a good complement. I think they work together. Some of the things that over the years that offenses have gone to attack fire zones are a little more vulnerable to man pressures. And I think with a mix, you have a chance at least to keep the offense. The offenses are very, very skilled, as you know, BMAC today. They were very, very skilled versus that defense that we're talking about. They were very, very skilled when I played. It's the top level of football in the world, end of story. But they had these hot reads and automatic checks, and they had ways of determining who was coming and then going to the empty spot. They still can do it. Guys like Manning and Brady are so good at it, and they hold you up there and they get a look and a feel, and then they're so accurate with what they're doing that it's hard to get them off the field. And the thing about the zone pressure, I've started thinking in my mind, well, what if we showed one thing but actually ended up rolling a different way? And instead of putting everybody in a man-to-man situation where they could just break away from where the pressure was coming and go to work one-on-one on one of our defenders, if we couldn't area people and even trap with some people and have them thrown into a trap player as opposed to thrown away from a man player. And essentially, that was a concept. There was a need that the time in the league had come. The offenses pretty much had the answer to the zero blitzes. And as they say, necessity is the mother of invention. It was time for some other form of pressure. And it's still around, so the concept must be fairly valid. Talking about probably in the early 80s when I started doing it, so it's 25 or 30 years. You got more people doing it, so you've got more ramifications. The offenses know more of what to do with it, but I think now the mixture with the zone pressure in with the man pressure is probably the way it's going to be for a while. It hadn't changed for 25 years or so. If I've got anything that I'll leave the game, it will be the concept of a zone pressure. The first time that I thought it was ready for a game was in a preseason game. And Archie Griffin, who's an old Ohio State Buckeye, in fact, he's the only man to win the Heisman Trophy twice. He was a halfback. We had his brother, Raymond Griffin, played corner for us. And the first time I sent David Fulcher, our strong safety, and then trapped him behind him with the corner, the quarterback threw the ball right to the corner, and Ray Griffin went in 60 yards for a touchdown with it. And I said, this might be something worth expanding on. But it had instant success, and I think that helped with the credibility with the coaching staff. Today, you can't go to a game that you don't see some zone pressure. I always felt that I had an advantage because from being in at the ground floor with the foundation of building the zone pressures, I could take a look at something and know right away what the weakness was and what had to be done to fix it. And over the years, because of that ability to instantly correct, I think we were much more effective with it than any team. The Steelers are the ones that took it out of the universe, really. The right combination of scheme and players, you guys made them click, man.
I mean, we had a great coach to install the game plan and get us prepared for what we would see week in and week out. A transition to week 13, like I said, the Steelers won that ball game 33-10, a fairly cold ball game. If you go back in time, the Patriots were the favorites. They were a 2.5-point favorite, even with their backup quarterback, Matt Castle, starting. We entered the ball game, coach. We were 8-3 after beating the Bengals the previous week. The Patriots, they were 7-4 after beating the Miami Dolphins the previous week also. James Harrison, as we know him as Debo, had an unbelievable game. 10 tackles, 2 sacks, 2 forced fumbles. Troy had an interception. Lawrence Timmons, my fellow Florida State Seminole, had an interception, coach, and he got ran down on the goal line by a tight end from about 20 yards, something that he probably would never live out. 89-yard return, but did not get the final yard for him to be able to get into the end zone. It's something that we laugh about consistently now.
The rest of his playing career, we never let him forget that.
Exactly. I look back at the tape from the highlight. I think we're in 57, which was a nickel dime call for us in our sub package, and LT had man-to-man coverage on the running back, and the running back ran it out. LT jumped right in front of it, and I remember everybody yelling, and we all put our touchdown hands up, you know, the signal for a touchdown, because we all thought he would get into the end zone. And Benjamin Watson came out of nowhere, ran him down from about 30 yards to be exact. Coach, do you remember that?
Oh, I'll never forget it. When LT went past me, he was flying. You know, Lawrence could run for
yes.
a guy. He could really run. I said, man, that sticks. They ain't catching him. And he got down about, it was probably all the way down the inside there, 20 before it happened, but it looked like an elephant jumped on his back and he couldn't hardly move his legs. And then he got inside the 10 and it was like he was in waist deep water, and finally a couple got jumped on his back. I think they tackled him on about the 1. But it definitely cemented the game, because he maybe didn't score, but I think it just took us one play to go ahead and get in. But Lawrence never, ever lived that down. we never exactly. let him live it.
No question. Looking at some of the game notes, so like I said, Matt Castle was a starting quarterback. He only threw for 169 yards, 2 interceptions. He was sacked 5 times from the Pittsburgh Steelers defense. Randy Moss, of course, who was on that team, an outstanding wide receiver, we know, Hall of Famer, one of the best to ever do it, only had 4 catches for 45 yards. He was being shadowed by Ike Taylor. Coach, when looking at opposing offenses that have elite players at certain positions, and for this game, Randy Moss was that elite guy. What's the game plan going into that week of knowing that you have one of the best in the world at what they do, and finding a way to neutralize him, make him a non-factor? How do you come up with game plans or strategies against those type of players?
Well, my philosophy there has always been they're great players. They're great. They have the statistics for a reason. It's because they're better at what they do than the average bear. And you have to go in the game understanding that that you're playing against a special athlete here. I remember early when Randy first came into the league, I mean, our DBs, you were one, you know, you're used to fast guys. And then you play against them every day on the practice field, and you play against them every Sunday on the game day field. But when he was with Minnesota then, I believe, when he came in the league, we were playing them in Minnesota. And my guys come off the field, and there was a different look on their face, the DBs. And I'm talking to them, and I'm telling them, you got to do this, got to do that, got to do this. And they just look back at me and say, Coach, he's fast. I said, I know he's fast. I'm telling you what you got to do to slow him down a little bit. But when you get a player that the opponent who is used to speed comes out there and says, oh, she's really fast, you know he's special. My philosophy in that situation has always been, you know he's going to catch some balls. He's going to have some plays. You cannot allow that man to dictate the game. You cannot allow the one punch that you know the opponent's got. If it's a right cross, you got to make him beat you with a jab. If it's a right hook, an uppercut, you can't let him hit you with the uppercut. So you got to take that guy's dominance away. And to me, that was always easier than saying you got to stop so-and-so, because if he was stoppable, he wouldn't have the reputation that they have. I'm talking about great running backs here, wonderful tight ends. In this case, we're talking about a wide receiver who was probably the best deep ball receiver that's ever played.
Mm-hmm.
In that particular game, the way we stopped him, we had a great player on him at Ike. That's the first thing that we had. But we had great pressure on the quarterback all night. And the quarterback doesn't throw quite as accurately when he's laying on his back as he mm-hmm. does when he's standing up. And as you alluded to the sack total there, but Castle's quarterback rating that game was under 10. I don't remember exactly what it was.
Yeah, it was low. It was under 10.
Under 10. That means that he was sacked more times probably than balls he completed. But as a coach, you design a game plan, again, around what your guys can do. And then you match it against the strengths that the other team has. And then you let your players go play. And that particular game, the New England was great then as they are now. Brady has a winning record against us, but we had some really good games against him. We beat him, at home, a couple of times, a couple of big games. We beat him at home. I remember that. And I do remember this game, but Brady wasn't in there. And to be totally honest with you, I wasn't upset that he wasn't in there. But in that game up there, I remember it was a typical late season New England game. It was a raw night, a mm-hmm. misty night, as I recall. And I think we were behind at half, weren't we?
Yeah, actually, it was tied. It was 10-10.
It was a close game. I don't know that we ever had a lead till the second half. And then they were, I don't know, at one point the game, I think they were 0 for 12 on third down. So mm-hmm. when you're dominating a team on third down and getting off the field consistently, with the offense that we had, it was just a matter of time before they were going to get up there somewhere near 30 points. And I didn't think anybody was going to get 30 points against that defense anyplace. So I thought we was in pretty good shape once we got to some turnovers going there in the second half. But that team grew as the season went along. And we had some injuries earlier in the year on both sides of the ball. And at the end of the year when we made that run, we were a totally different team than the one that posted the record we had going into the playoffs. That team was unbeatable at the end of the year.
Yes, sir. Talking about third downs, the inability to sustain drives and create first downs was something the Patriots were not able to do. Coach, they were 1 of 13 on third down, completed one third down opportunity throughout the ball game. And in the red zone, they were 1 of 4. That's winning football and talking about going into half tied 10-10 on the road in a playoff atmosphere. The adjustments that you made for the defense, because we did not allow 1 point in the second half. Talk a little bit about your game plan as far as your adjustments when things seem to not work as well as you would like them to do in the first half, changing things up a little bit, giving them a different look in the second half.
People would be totally amazed at how little time you have at halftime, but the time the players have a chance to take care of some things. And you actually, you know, it takes a while to get in from the field, and then it takes a while to get everybody ready to go out to the field. And I think you only get 15 minutes anyhow. So you're talking about actually talking to the players maybe 7 or 8 minutes, because you want to have at least 7 or 8 minutes to try to collect your thoughts of what you're going to try to do in the second half. So that's how quick it's got to happen. And we've never got too enamored with gross changes at halftime, but sometimes you have to change direction. I don't think we changed that much in that particular game because, again, we were winning on third down. We were forcing the field goals. And in the long run, if you hold the score down and give the offense a chance to win the game, you're doing your job as a defense. And you got to keep the opponent from controlling the ball. You got to get the ball back for your guys, and you got to keep that scoreboard in a situation where your guys don't have to score 40 points every week to win. And those are things that I felt pretty confident that you guys were going to do. And you know, we went so many weeks in that game, in that year, nobody scored anything hardly. And I just remember adjusting the pressures a little bit, but I thought we were on the right track, particularly with that third down statistic, and we were getting good pressure. And then you guys got the turnovers, and most of those came in the second half. Yeah. And blew the game open really with your turnovers. And sometimes those are created. Most of the time they're created. Sometimes the offense makes a mistake, and it was kind of a combination of that. I just think we eroded them down. We wore them down, and that's what happened in that game.
Coach, talking about turnovers and pressures, James Harrison in the third quarter just pretty much dominated the game by himself. He had 2 sacks, 2 forced fumbles, and that gave us the opportunity from the offensive standpoint to put points on the scoreboard. And clearly that's where we won the ball game. Talk a little bit about James Harrison, James Debo Harrison, or Silverback. You know, he had many nicknames, there in the Steeler organization, but what made him so special?
Well, he's one of my favorite stories, and, I don't speak too much, I don't do a lot of public speaking, and, I never want to take it away from my job, but now that I'm retired, I might do some, but I'm not much for it. But he's one of my favorite stories when I do speak, because James Harrison, I think, was released from the National Football League roster 5 times. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's right. It might have been 6. I'm damn sure it was at least 4. But I think it was 5 times that he tried to make the league and was released, and he persevered. And I've always been proud to say, I think he was released by the Steelers 3 times, but I've always been proud to say I was never part of the coaching staff when he got released, because when I saw him on the practice field in training camp, that was my first introduction to him. And I watched our guys. I always watch a few days of practice before I even really start talking about the players too much. And Coach Keith Butler was our linebacker coach at that time. He's a coordinator now and a great coach. I said, "Coach Butler," I said, "who's this Harrison?" And he said, well, he's from Kent State, and he filled me in a little background, this and that. And I said, well, I haven't seen anybody block him yet. And we'd been in camp about 3 days or 2 days. I think we need to figure out some way to keep him on his squad. Well, that was the first team that he made. It was the first year that I had come back to Pittsburgh to coach. And James helped himself that year in the preseason by being a fantastic special teams player. In his first year, that's the way he made the team. But we still weren't sure exactly what we had with him, but we knew we had a strong guy who was almost impossible to block. We didn't realize that he was that good a pass rusher. We saw from the drills that he could rush the passer. But we went up to play Cleveland. You remember this. And Jerry Porter got in a fight with Cleveland's fullback before the damn game even started.
Actually, it was the running back. I think it was William Green.
Yeah. Yeah. And they threw them both out of the game before the game even started. The whole team had almost gone off the field when the ref came over to Coach Cowher, and he said, Porter's out of the game. And Dale came to me, and he said, Dick, he said, they thrown Joey out of the game. So we were leaving the field, and Coach Butler was already in the locker room, and I went over to him, and I said, go get Harrison and find out what he can run, because I don't want to call any defenses early. That's going to, make him tense up, because he's going to be playing the whole game. And Keith thought I was kidding. He went, ho, ho, ho. I said, no, it's not ho, ho, ho. I said, he's in, and he's playing the whole football game. And I think James had 2 sacks. I think he had 3 other quarterback pressures. I think he had double-digit tackles. He forced 2 fumbles, and we come off the field after the game, and I said, I think we found us a pretty good football player. I've had the honor to coach 3 most valuable players of the National Football League defense, and they were all Steelers. Troy Polamalu, James Harrison, they won the award. But I always count James Ferrier as the most, the outstanding defensive player, his great season. And the linebacker from Baltimore won it that year, and James finished 2nd in the voting. But our defense outplayed Baltimore's defense in every statistic. Our team outplayed them. We had a better record. We won our division. James Ferrier should have been the MVP that year, I think. But James Harrison was. He won it the year that he intercepted the ball and took it back all the way in the Super Bowl, which to me is the greatest football play I've ever seen. Offense, defense, special teams, whatever you want. That play was unbelievable.
Yeah, and he did that by accident. He wasn't even supposed to be there. He was supposed to blitz.
Yeah. Well, you know what I always tell when people ask about that? I say, well, I always taught my players to be innovative. James said, when I asked him about that, James said that he knew there weren't any timeouts left, and he knew that they couldn't run the ball, because if they ran it and didn't make it, they wouldn't be able to kick their field goal. And so he said, I engaged my guy and then dropped back and looked for the pass that I knew was coming somewhere. And their quarterback, who was a great player, he threw it, and James picked it off. But the greatness of that play is not the pick, but the run. He ran. He must have ran 150 yards with that play.
Mm-hmm.
It's another play that I used as a teaching aid everywhere I've been since then, which is not much, but I would show you guys a lot, where people came from clear off the other side of the field and got key blocked all the way down. And Deshae got the key block right there that got him started. And it was just a great team effort. And you might agree with this, you might not, but I think it's hard to not agree with it. James Harrison was probably the best conditioned athlete on the football team. And he was unbelievable. There's not any other 265-pound guys that could run 125 yards like that. And it was about 100-degree temperature. Mm-hmm. It was the last play of the half. If you remember, James just fell into the corner of the end zone and laid there. But after he got that halftime break and a little bit of oxygen, he came back and played a dominant second half. And that's what kind of condition he was in. Most people that size, if they ran that far, that would be it for them for the day. They might be out there, but they wouldn't be dominating the opponent. But Harrison was a special man. He's retiring this year, so I think it's unique, but I'll always remember that he and I came in together to Pittsburgh and we're going out of the league together.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite, all-time favorite stories of, man, it ain't over till it's over, and you're never beaten until the game ends. He never gave up. He never gave up on his dream of playing in the National Football League. He was over in Europe. He was in Baltimore. He was in Pittsburgh. He was here. He was there. And he got the door shut in his face every place that he went. But he never gave up. And finally, the situation was where we had to have him. And by God, he became one of the best football players that you'd ever want to see.
Yes, yes. He was a great teammate. You know, when you look at Debo from the outside looking in, many people were intimidated by him. But to us in the building, I mean, Debo, he was a big, you know, he was soft as pudding as far as, you know, his sense of humor, his personality. We used to have some good times, and just seeing how he evolved to be one of the best pass rushers in the game. And I think he will be a Hall of Famer, and just you seeing his entire story pretty much develop as a guy that's never quit on his dreams. And that year right there, he had an unbelievable campaign along with Troy. Real quick, Coach, you know, I need to hear your opinion about Troy Polamalu as a player, because of course I play with Troy and I try to tell detailed stories about Troy. But what was it about Troy that set him apart from any other player that you've coached in your career?
That's another one of my favorite topics, is talking about Troy. I will say this before we leave James. We had the bookend outside linebackers with Lamar Woodley and James.
Yep.
And your defense, when you're solid out there on the outside like they were, neither one of those guys could you block at all in the run. And both of them, if you left them one-on-one with anybody, were going to get pressure. They were both a coach's dream. And one of the super strengths of that defense was those two outside linebackers that forced everything up inside of that meat grinder. And you've already named some of the players that were sitting up inside there, and one of them was Troy. The thing that when I try to explain Troy Polamalu's greatness, he moved at a different level than the human body moves. That's the only way I can explain it. His point A to point B speed for a guy over 200 pounds was off the charts. And I would have people, women, older women, that just football fans, and I'd be in a conversation and they would say, I'll bet you can't guess who my favorite Steeler is. I said, I would say, unfailingly, I'd say, I'll bet I can. It's Troy Polamalu. And they would say, how did you know that? I said, because I get asked that question by about 5,000 people a year, and it's always Troy is the answer. Because whether you had a background in football or just enjoyed watching football and rooting for the Steelers, you could sit in the stands or watch on television and see that this guy was moving at a different rate than the other athletes, very gifted athletes, superior athletes. Troy had that shot out of a cannon, point A to point B, and it took the quarterbacks at least 4 years to understand that everything that they see in practice every day against world-class football players, you got to throw it out the window when Troy's around because he's moving at a different rate. And that's as close as an explanation to Troy's greatness as I can give you. Carnell Lake was very, very similar because Carnell was a 218-pound safety that was he would run right with Rod Woodson, who was a world-class track star. I mean, world-class, competed in Europe and won. But Carnell could move with him. I don't know, you know, your memory's always a little better with the guy you coached the most recent, but I don't know if anyone ever moved any quicker from point A to point B than Troy did. He was like a corner, but yeah. he was a safety. We were playing a game one day, and the quarterback threw a flare pass behind the line of scrimmage. It was 6 yards deep, and Troy had dropped into a zone, so he was 12 yards deep. So he was 18 to 20 yards away from the guy that caught the ball. And before he could turn up field and gain any yards, he threw him for a loss. It looked like someone just shot him out of a cannon, like the old circus act. But he was... He had phenomenal reaction ability, and like all of you guys, you never were beaten. You never gave up the game. You never gave up the play. You never gave up the quarter. You were always competitive. You fought individually and collectively, and Troy was probably the epitome of that. His thirst to be successful, to win the down, well, all you're ever going to get is a tie on most of you guys, but Troy for sure. I don't mind talking about guys like Harrison and Troy and Casey Hampton and Brett Kiesel, Aaron Smith. It was a pretty good outfit.
Oh, yeah, we had outstanding players. A lot of future Hall of Famers on that team, in my opinion. To follow
no
up.
No doubt.
Yeah, so, you know, I can't wait to get a chance to attend those ceremonies. To follow up the second half production from the Steelers, like I said, we dominated in the second half. We scored 13 points, allowed zero. In the fourth quarter, we scored 10 points, allowed zero. And let Lawrence Timmons touchdown that we talked about earlier provide the last scoring opportunity, scoring touchdown for the Pittsburgh Steelers. We ended up, after that week, we're 9-5. Pretty much almost through the season, and the following week, which will be week 14, we have another special guest joining us here on the podcast, no other than Deshae Townsend, another one of Coach LeBeau's favorite players to recap the week 14 victory against the Dallas Cowboys. But once again, Coach, man, it was an honor being able to get you on to go back in time a little bit and talk about that storied season led by a historical great defense. You were the catalyst for that team, the mastermind for that team. Hearing some of these legendary stories, man, you don't get this every day.
Well, thank you, B-Mac. You alluded early when you started the program that you looked at yourself as a historian, and you were always kind of unique for a young player coming up and the interest that you had in the history of the game. And in this conversation we've had today, we really didn't talk very much about a lot of players on that great defense from that year. But you know, like those corners, Deshae and Ike, they were just week in and week out. You couldn't do anything with any of them. And I did talk about the fact that we had no weaknesses anywhere, but Casey was probably the best nose tackle I've ever seen. And I know there's been a lot of great ones, but you could never block him ever. And Aaron Smith, it was never on his, off his feet. And Brett, they never quit. I mean, And that linebacker core, I never had such a group of linebackers. I mean, they were just fantastic. I mean, you can go right down everybody, and I think that's the reason the numbers are what they are from that defense. And I think that's the reason that I believe that those numbers are not going to be matched again in the National Football League. No one's come close to them. And that the great Seattle defense that won the championship and everybody talks about, their numbers are not anywhere close to that. You can look it up in the book, but it's true, believe me. I have a special spot in my heart for that season, for that group. And it's always wonderful to have a chance to talk to a part of that defense as we have today. And you take care of yourself, B-Man.
I definitely will. And like I said, Coach, it's an honor. Once again, Steeler fans, you had an opportunity recapping the Week 13 victory against the New England Patriots with no other than the Hall of Fame, legendary, iconic man, Dick LeBeau, 14-year NFL player, 45 years as an NFL coach, two-time Super Bowl champion with the Pittsburgh Steelers. In the words of Dick LeBeau, adios.
Great day to be alive, man.
Yes, sir. It's a great day to be alive. Thanks, Coach.
Adios.